When it comes to conservation, it's easy to get excited about protecting creatures that make you go, oh, like, oh, what a fluffy koala, or oh, what a cute lizard. But I'm not sure I've ever heard someone go, oh, what an adorable freshwater mussel. I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Occam's Razor, a soapbox for science. And this week, we're hearing from Michelle Hobbs, who wants you to know that freshwater mussels really are worthy of awe.
I'd like to acknowledge the Yuggera and Turrbal peoples of the lands that we're on tonight, Meanjin, Brisbane, and pay my respects to their elders and my elders as well. What is your earliest memory of water? For me, it's sneaking off down the creek on the family farm at the age of 4 or 5 and jumping off the bridge, fully clothed, for a lovely swim, then scrambling back up the banks and back home to my horrified mum. I'm not really a lab coat kind of scientist. I just got back from yesterday from a field trip canoeing down the Mary River for a few days. It's a couple of hours north from here. We were looking for rare and endangered lungfish, turtles and freshwater mussels with a crew of scientists, local Aboriginal people and catchment rehabilitation specialists. It was really fun. This is what I love most about my job, working out in the bush, out on the water, with the goal to look after the river. Our relationships with water are often pretty primal. Water carries a lot of meaning for all of us. In Australia, human-water relationships are among the oldest in the world, with people arriving in Australia's north at least 65,000 years ago. Rivers are places of great cultural significance. They're critical to human survival in this hot, dry continent, but also because they give us so much water, food, and they're very soothing for the soul. I'm a descendant of the Bidjara peoples and Dungari peoples on my mum's side, and also of European descent from several generations of pineapple farmers on my dad's side. I'm a freshwater scientist, and so I'm a bit of a rarity in my field. While there are more and more women in environmental sciences, which is great, there are very few Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people in freshwater science. I'm not sure why exactly, but it can be pretty hard to become what you can't see. I was lucky that I had wonderful women science teachers when I was in high school, and my dad and my brother are also scientists, so I was able to have that confidence to just go out and do it. I studied marine biology. Then my first job was working on freshwater fish for mining and water resources in some beautiful places, with wantoks in Papua New Guinea, with crocodile people in Western Cape York in Queensland. And I got looked after by some wonderful people in small villages in Laos, Sulawesi and in Mindanao. I was often the only woman on field trips, and that came with its own set of challenges. I was sometimes treated a bit like royalty, which is very unlike how local women were treated, because I was seen as a white woman. On the other hand, there were sometimes concerns that I was travelling with a bunch of men without my husband, so that could be a bit awkward at times. On the other hand, the main things I got from these travels was an appreciation that local people are an invaluable source of information. We always asked them about the best fishing places, the weather, how big the last wet season was, etc. Their daily observations always enhanced what we were able to achieve as outsiders dropping in to collect data for just a few days. Studying humanities helped me move into water quality at state government, where part of my role was asking communities what they thought of the water management plans in the Murray-Darling Basin. Our talks about water quality were always scheduled after the ones about the water allocations, so that really took a lot of heat away from us. As long as you've actually got water, the quality seems a lot less important. But most significantly, I had the great privilege of spending time with the Aboriginal peoples of the Northern Basin, including some from my own mob, Bidjara, and neighbouring mobs, Gungari, Kunya, Kuma, and many others. I listened to stories about being excluded from decision-making, being excluded from water ownership, even just from accessing the river to swim, to fish, and to feed their old people. This is a big grievance for many people, and theoretically, everyone can freely access the river because it's Crown land, right? But in practice, many property owners fence right across the river and banks to prevent access or to keep their cattle from wandering. after said cattle have been free to have a drink and a crap in the river. If there was one water quality problem that I could solve, it would be to fence all the cattle out of all the rivers and allow the banks to regenerate. So after policy, I came back to academia. So now I'm doing my PhD and researching freshwater mussels and the roles that they play in rivers. So mussels are bivalves. They're like pippies or oysters or scallops, except they don't swim like scallops. So they have two shells and a muscular foot. They are powerful filter feeders, the filtration systems of rivers, so like kidneys. They feed by pumping water through their gills, and in the process they remove algae and bacteria and sediment. They can filter up to 30 litres of water a day. So they are the river health indicators. They also accumulate pollutants, and they're sensitive to changes in river connectivity, like dams or big droughts. They also make nutrients more available to other organisms, and their hard shells provide homes for algae, snails and bugs to live on. So the presence of mussels means riverbeds are more productive. Mussels are also hugely culturally significant to Aboriginal peoples in Australia, to Maori peoples in New Zealand, and First Nations people in North America, as food, as tools, as jewellery, and in artwork and in ceremony. Across Australia, mussel shells are often the main material in sacred freshwater middens, layers of shell which have accumulated over millennia, places where people have returned again and again to camp and to eat together. Such places also encode ecological information. For example, middens indicate a history of good mussel habitat nearby and probably good habitat for fish that eat mussels. Mussels are still important for cultural identity, so certain plants and animals in Aboriginal culture are seen as family members. So what happens when they start disappearing from the local area? Mussels are one of the most threatened groups of freshwater animals on the planet. 22 species have already gone extinct. In the north of Australia's Murray-Darling Basin, the last drought saw most of the endemic river mussels die from lack of water, along with millions of iconic fish, Murray cod, silver perch and yellow belly. I was part of a team that surveyed the mussel remains for survivors. The sight of thousands of dead shells amongst the dry riverbeds of the Barker, the Darling River, was completely heartbreaking for many people. Despite this, though, in Australia, mussels are rarely specifically mentioned in management plans. Instead, the more obvious or charismatic animals, such as fish and water birds, tend to be the focus. This is slowly changing, but limited data on how many mussels there are out there means that most species don't yet qualify for threatened species lists. In general, conservation efforts focus on species that people think are adorable or economically valuable, like koalas or barramundi, so it makes it hard for an animal like a mussel that doesn't even have a face. This cute bias is a well-accepted fact in conservation, which modellers and planners take into account when they're designing protected areas. Aboriginal peoples have a very holistic view. The ecosystem as a whole and all those relationships are important, not just a few species, because without all of those relationships, we know the ecosystem will collapse. Australia is made up of a rich tapestry network of more than 500 distinct language groups, each with their own culture, their own ecosystems, and important species that occur on their lands. So when a species disappears from one country, even if it still occurs on a neighbouring country, it's a big loss for those people who no longer have access to that species. Aboriginal interests are rarely considered when we talk about conservation, either because it's assumed that biodiversity targets will provide for Aboriginal needs, or because it's assumed that Aboriginal peoples are only interested in what we call cultural heritage, so scar trees and old artefacts and rock art. But in fact, the entire landscape is cultural heritage. In Australia, ecosystems have been deliberately shaped and managed to reduce fire risk, to maximise food production, and to improve human access. So my research includes taking trips down rivers and talking with Aboriginal communities about mussels and river health, because they are the real experts on the rivers. Indigenous knowledge is the result of thousands of years of observation of the natural world passed down over generations. In contrast, in science, we collect thousands of data, but over short timescales, focusing on what is repeatable and consistent. Both are valid, but provide different types of information. And we need to learn to use both sources for sustainable water management now and into the future. recently there has been a lot of interest in Indigenous knowledges and how they can help science, policy, climate change, and basically save the world. And they can definitely do all of those things, but it's not enough to document and extract the knowledge and apply it as policymakers see fit. The knowledge exists within a cultural framework, and this is the intellectual property of the community that it came from. The knowledge will not tell you how to improve economic return. It will tell you how to improve sustainability, but only when you're willing to make the necessary changes to the status quo and accept that water is sacred and has a value far above what you can pay and must be treated accordingly. The best way to support the use of Indigenous knowledges is to support Indigenous people in studying and working in science and policy so that they can be the voice for their communities that speaks in both worlds.
That was Michelle Hobbs, an associate lecturer and PhD candidate at the Australian Rivers Institute at Griffith University and a descendant of the Bidjara and Dungari peoples. Michelle was speaking at our Occam's Razor live event at World Science Festival Brisbane on Jagera and Turrbal land. I'm Tegan Taylor, your Occam's Razor host, and I'll be back next week with even more awesome science.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.